You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. I am Rebecca Zimmerman. Children with developmental disabilities and their families face a range of challenges when trying to ensure that they get the care and education they need, and policy plays a significant role in the lives of kids with developmental disabilities. In Arkansas, some major policy changes around how kids and families access care have recently rolled out. We will talk about that and other policy issues impacting kids with developmental disabilities with three guests: Cindy Oldberg with Arkansas Waiver Association, David Deere with Partners for Inclusive Communities, and Thomas Nichols with the Developmental Disability Rights Association, do you want to go ahead and get started and talk a bit about your organization, Thomas?
Sure. So Disability Rights Arkansas is what's called a protection and advocacy organization. We are federally funded. We operate under a series of 9 grants from the federal government, and we provide legal services and advocacy for individuals with disabilities. There's an organization like ours in every state and territory in the United States, and we are required to have one of these organizations in the state in order to receive funding from agencies like Health and Human Services and Rehab Services Administration. Basically, we are a legal services and advocacy organization made up of lawyers and advocates.
And Partners for Inclusive Communities is actually a companion program to Disability Rights Arkansas. We're established under the same federal legislation, and we work for the full inclusion of people with disabilities into community life. And our particular role is we are a university center for excellence in developmental disabilities, which we're part of the University of Arkansas, and our role is to be a bridge between the research that goes on at the academic level and the community. So we do a lot of research and training, and most of our clients are actually agencies, although we do have a few demonstration projects that are doing direct services with individuals.
And I'm Cindy Alberding. I'm honored to be here with the two, David, Thomas, but we are not a sister agency. We are the Arkansas Waiver Association. We're an association of individuals, parents, families that believe in quality community integrated supports. The Waiver Association started almost 30 years ago when the waiver started, and we've gone fairly strong since then. The big changes that are coming within the system impact waiver providers directly. So at this time, our organization is pretty active and concerned about what's coming.
Well, I wanted to start by asking first, how are children screened for developmental disabilities, and when does that normally happen?
Well, that ideally it happens very early. Unfortunately, in reality, a lot of times kids are a little older before anyone suspects they have a delay. And there tends to be the attitude, well, let's wait and see if they grow out of it. And we work really hard to try to counteract that. And kids can be screened when they're, could be as infants, certainly as toddlers they should be. And the reason for that's so important is the younger the kids are, the more responsive they are to interventions, the more benefit they'll gain from that when their brains are still developing, they're still making neural connections, the brains are being fully wired. So ideally, you know, it would be in the first year, 18 months of life.
Yeah, so you know when if you have a young child and the pediatrician asks about milestones that that child is supposed to be achieving according to their experience and training, and a lot of that can lead to recommendations to have a child tested. If they're not speaking at an age that the pediatrician feels is appropriate, then typically what will happen is they'll refer you to the Department of Human Services for an evaluation, which might lead to early intervention treatment. Which could be, you know, speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, in order to make sure that it's something that the child can benefit from and possibly overcome, or if it's something that's going to need to be addressed further in the child's life. So it really starts with ensuring that you have a good pediatric care, that you're going to your pediatrician when you're supposed to, and informing them of your child's milestones, so that these services can be opened up to you. And from there, it's up to the therapists and the care providers to make sure that other services aren't needed. But it's not just your pediatrician. You know, your daycare worker might be able to refer you if you have concerns. You should definitely contact DHS to get some of those early developmental screenings out of the way, for sure.
And it could be done by the family as well. They could suspect the child has delays. We really advocate using a standardized screening instrument, because a lot of times, you know, our personal judgment or even professional judgment may not be real accurate. And a lot of times people tend to minimize delays that kids have. And the way the system works, it's much easier to get into service when you're an infant or a toddler up to age 3, because we'd rather have kids that don't really need it that get into care than to miss the ones that really need it. So they have a very broad eligibility for young kids. And a lot of them may have therapy for a brief period of time and they've overcome their delays. But then there are other kids that really need the early intensive interventions to have better outcomes in life. So while they don't have to use a standardized instrument to do this, it can be done just observing milestones. It's a lot more precise if you use standardized instruments. And there's been a group in the state that's really been promoting using the ages and stages instrument. That's one that the family can fill out. They can give to the doctor. It can be scored. And it'll say, yes, they either pass the screen or they fail. If they fail the screen, then they'd be referred for more in-depth testing.
And I think families can also go to the Parent Training and Information Center. Every state has one funded center that is called the Parent Training and Information Center. And in Arkansas, that's really split between two entities. One is the Center for Exceptional Families. The other one's Northwest Arkansas Community Parent Research Center. They're funded out of the federal pot of money for special education, and so their services are free. So for families that have concerns and want more information, those are both good centers to try and contact as well.
And if they qualify for early intervention services, those are free also.
Yeah, and that goes back to the idea that we as a state, you'll find this in every state, because the theory is that is totally valid theory, is that if you can treat these issues early on, like David said, when the neurons are forming, the neural passages are forming, then it will lead to less dependence on services in the future, potentially. So we want to be able to treat children for these issues while they're developing, so that it might lessen the effects on their ability to live a happy and healthy life in the future.
And developmental disabilities are services that are lifelong in nature. So we're not talking about...
it's not a cure.
It's not a cure. There is no cure. And this is not somebody that has something for a little while and then it goes away, like a broken leg or those sorts of things. These are for the children that have autism, epilepsy, cerebral palsy, mental retardation, the conditions that are going to be for the remainder of their life, or similar conditions to mental retardation, for the remainder of their lives. They're always going to need some level of support. And the earlier you get in there and start that support, the less they're going to need down the road.
You're listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. We're talking about issues impacting kids with developmental disabilities. If you have questions for our guests, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And Cindy, you have it right in the name, so I'm going to ask you my next question. What is the Developmental Disability Waiver Program?
The Developmental Disability Waiver started 30 years ago as an alternative to institutionalization. Kids were coming out of public school, having been integrated with their classmates for all that time, and the options that were available to them for life after school were pretty limited 30 years ago. So the waivers program started to offer employment, individualized services, even supported living where people could live in apartments with assistance. And that program has continued and become one of the most popular programs across the state over the last 30 years. It's now at the Department of Human Services, they now call it the CES waiver. They just changed the name. So watch out, because names change sometimes.
What does that stand for?
CES is Community and Employment Supports.
We live in a world of acronyms.
But if you have an individual that has a developmental disability at birth, you can get on that waiting list. You don't have to wait. It's from birth till death that services are available. They're available all over the state of Arkansas. Unfortunately, there's a long waiting list, and some people get frustrated and don't apply. But we encourage everyone, get on that list, because by the time you're ready to graduate out of school, you're going to want those services.
And so if parents want to enroll their children in this program, they have to get something from their doctor and go to DHS. How does that work?
It all comes through DHS. Mm-hmm. And DHS has one of its divisions is DDS, Developmental Disability Services. That's who administers the waiver. So what people would do is work on that diagnosis of developmental disability, and their county office should help them do that. Work on that diagnosis, and as soon as they're diagnosed, ask for an application for waiver services. Don't be thwarted by somebody saying it's a long list or it takes too long. Yes, it does take a long time, but I promise it's worth it. And all of that comes out of their local DHS office. If anybody has trouble with that application process, Thomas, I think probably calling over to your office would be a smart idea.
Sure, yeah. So one of the services we provide for people is if for some reason they're denied eligibility to participate in the waiver, we can assist them in appealing that decision or advocating for them with their county office if we don't think an appeal is warranted or necessary at the time. The eligibility process is it's very complex. There are categories under which you can be found eligible. You have to have a certain testing has to be done before you can be deemed eligible. It's called adaptive functioning testing. Under some circumstances, you'll be required to have an IQ test. And DHS isn't necessarily going to tell you all of that up front or assist you in getting it necessarily, and probably you're going to want to take that with you when you apply. But certainly if anybody has any questions just about that eligibility component, for sure call us and ask about it, and we can tell you exactly what to do in order to ensure that if your child's eligible, you'll have everything you need to take with you when you apply.
And what's the number?
So our number is, it's local here in Little Rock, so it's 501-296-1775. We have an 800 number, but I'll have to dig it out of my pocket.
No, I think the we only go 90 miles outside of Little Rock, so I think you've got everyone covered here that's listening.
And I might mention there are a couple of other programs that will help people with the application. One of them is the Family to Family Health Information Center, and that's housed at the Arkansas Disability Coalition. And their number is, of course, 501-614-7020. And then the other one that has historically done this, I understand they're undergoing some changes, but as far as I know, they will still help, and that's the Title V program. That's now Title V Children with Chronic Conditions. And their number is 800 482-5850, extension 22277.
And how is the waiver program funded? Because my understanding is that it covers a wide range of services. So how does that work?
It does. It covers a lot of ages, a lot of disabilities, and a lot of services. And the way that waivers work, there are many different kinds of waivers. The way that waivers work is the federal government sets out a menu of services that Medicaid will pay for out around in all the states. This is what you can have. When states assess their need and try to decide what else they want, they can request waivers to the rules that Medicaid has set out. And that's where the word waiver got started. So you hear a lot of people talking about the current waivers that we have where people work for Medicaid. There are aging waivers. There's this waiver. There is some new stuff happening for people that have behavioral health issues. All of those are waivers. And all that means is they have requested the federal government waive the restrictions that are around current Medicaid. With straight Medicaid, you have to almost be in a facility to receive any service. What this does is waive the requirement that you live in that facility and let you have those services in your own home. So it's all federal money that comes in. It's Medicaid money, but it is a special program.
So does the state, do you think, adequately cover all the needed services? Are there still some gaps in services that Medicaid waiver program doesn't cover? Or?
Well, it's not all federal money. The state has to match all Medicaid dollars, and they do with the waiver just like they do with the basic Medicaid program. And there, it is a balancing act because it's expensive to do this. And even though the federal government pays more of the cost to the state is still quite a bit. And so I think we would all agree there are services that families would like to have and that individuals probably need that they don't get. So it's a balancing act between what the state decides it can afford and what families need. And, you know, it's hard to find that sweet spot where you're really matching both.
Yeah, and, you know, just by virtue of the fact that we do have a waiting list for people who are eligible for waiver services means that the state is not providing enough for people with disabilities to be able to get the services they need to stay in their home.
And some people get good care, good services, and other people are waiting. They're getting nothing. My understanding is our number now is about 2,800 that are on the waiting list to get services.
And I think they're waiting for several years to get those services. To me, because the population is the group that people would label as individuals who have more severe needs, I see it as a group that we should try to help more than we would worry about people that had maybe less needs. I don't ever think there's enough for everyone. I wish we lived in a world where there was. But I have the feeling we're not going to see that day, or at least I'm not going to see that day. Maybe young people will see it. I won't. But because we're talking about people that sometimes these services are what gets you up in the morning. Sometimes this is how you eat food, is you have to have a helper from one of these different service packages. It's not somebody that comes in to entertain you. And it's not something that if you don't get it today, it's okay, you can get it tomorrow. These are critical services for people. And I think it's a shame that we have such a long waiting list.
There were new funds allocated, though, correct? I think there are some of the tobacco funds that are now going towards the waiver program.
Yeah, so the release of the tobacco funds to fund removing people from the waiting list, I think that funded about 500 people to be removed. So, you know, we still have a very, very long waiting list. And it's my understanding it's growing You know, day by day, week by week, it's only going to get larger unless we move people off of it. I feel like we're not at a pace that is really what is intended under our Olmstead plan to make sure that people are getting served in the community like they're supposed to. But yes, we did see several hundred people get removed from the waiting list thanks to the DEPACO settlement money.
And there is a plan for money that will come into the state with the movement to managed care that will be able to take additional people off the waiting list over the next several years. I think I've heard it may be over the next 3 or 4 years that they're moving people off, and it could be a significant number, maybe as large as 1,000, but that's still going to leave over 1,500 on the waiting list as it stands today.
Mm-hmm. No one gets added to it.
Assuming no one gets added, and remembering that a lot of these people that would still be left on the waiting list have been waiting for years. So it really is a huge issue. It's probably, I think for most of the advocates in the disability community, it is the biggest issue that we're dealing with.
And you are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. Today we're talking about policy issues facing kids and families with disabilities. If you have a question for one of our guests, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And since you bring up managed care, that's a pretty big policy. Can you talk a bit about what that is and what prompted this policy change?
My understanding of what prompted it, well, there are a couple of things. Most states are going to some form of managed care for the long-term services and supports, the sorts of services we've talked about. There's a lot of concern in government about the rising cost of Medicaid, and this is one way that they're approaching to try to control cost. In Arkansas, we had a second incentive, and that was we chose to expand basic Medicaid to people who were not extremely, extremely low income. When with the Affordable Care Act, we started covering people up to 138% of
with
federal
Medicaid
poverty.
Expansion.
With Medicaid expansion. In the first years, that was free to the state. Well, now we're entering a phase where the state begins picking up 5% and ultimately 10% of that cost. And the estimate is initially that will be about $50 million it will cost the state. And this is the way we're going to find that extra $50 million is by reducing spending to this entire group. And the rationale is that with managed care, we can provide better services more cheaply. And I think that is possible, but from looking at a lot of other states, I think we need to be very cautious about that because a number of states that have traveled this route already have not had a good experience with it. And so the devil's in the details.
Yeah, and Arkansas is doing something fairly unique with its foray into managed care with this. With this particular waiver, what they've done is they've established or allowed to establish four private entities called PASSES, Provider-Led Arkansas Shared Savings Entity. It's another one of those acronyms that are essentially groups of providers who will be offering these services, not just to individuals with developmental disabilities, but also those with behavioral health needs. Under both the state plan and the waiver. So they're going to act kind of as a conduit. They'll be paid a global amount of money for everybody that they're going to be serving in their past. And they're basically told by the state, here's what you're getting for the year. Make it work. for all the services for all these people who we have attributed to you, who are beneficiaries under your PAS and receiving services from you, and we hope it works out well. So the PAS is really going to control all of the care coordination and making sure that individuals have the services they need, and they're going to act basically in place of what Medicaid used to do, making sure all the providers are paid and providing those services.
Can you explain this PAS a bit more?
Sure.
Someone's talked to me about it before, but it's still a bit confusing to me. So you said it's a group of providers, so that's people that families would directly accessing service from, and they've joined together to be part of this PAS?
Well, providers like primary care physicians, hospitals, perhaps somebody who provides supported living services, any number of different
mental health services could be part of it.
Exactly. Anybody who is a healthcare provider can join a PAS as either just a member of the PAS that bills to that PAS and is basically an in-network provider for that PAS, or they can be part owner in it. See, where Arkansas really differs from a lot of the other states is we are requiring that 51% of each of these entities is owned by providers, led by providers. So that's where Arkansas departs from some of the other traditional managed care organizations. How better to explain it? I don't know.
I would have to say I think it's because we're starting with some of the more difficult long-term support populations than what a lot of states have started with. I think the developmental disability side is a really small number. The waiver program itself has been pretty strongly managed by the state, so I don't think that sees as big of a bang for the buck that the PAS could get. But I think what we'll see on the behavioral health side is that some real, true, good care coordination for those folks could do a world of good at keeping people out of emergency rooms, making sure people can afford their medications when needed, and really doing some continuity of care for those individuals. Long term, it could make some pretty substantial differences for that population that could be of great benefit.
But the basic approach is each person will be assessed for their level of need. They'll be placed into one of three tiers. And then the PAS will be paid a set rate for each individual that falls into that tier or that level of need. And then the PAS, or the managed care organization, will use that money to provide all their services. It's different from what we've done in the past, which is a fee-for-service. If you go to the doctor, there's a charge. If you're in a developmental program, you know, there's a daily rate that's charged. With this, there's one flat rate that covers all of their services. And the PAS, or the managed care organization, they call it assuming the risk for them. So if they spend more money, it's up to the PAS to cover that. If they spend less on someone, then that allows them to spend more on others. But it's a different way of financing. And this is common in managed care across the country. What's different, as Thomas pointed out, is that ours are owned by the providers.
So think about it like you have a health insurance company who charges premiums for your health insurance. And so all of that money comes in every month. And so you have this pool of money with which you have to manage the risk by paying out services from that. It really kind of operates in the same way. You're given a pool of money that represents premiums for the individuals who have to receive services. And if the money is not there to pay for those services, then that PAS just ends up suffering a loss if the services that are claimed are all medically necessary. So it's why it's called a full risk PAS.
So is it possible, and excuse me for trying to clarify so much.
It's but complicated.
But it is. If I'm a parent and I'm looking at the different pass options, is it possible that my primary care physician and my favorite therapist for my child are in different passes, so I'm going to have to choose which one I like more?
You really won't have to choose that in that way. What you're going to have to remember to ask your pass is whether or not they will do a sole source contract. A pass can give a contract to an out-of-network provider, whether that's your therapist, your doctor, it doesn't matter who. If they don't want to join that pass, if your pass will contract with that doctor directly for just your care, you will not have to choose between passes in that regard. So they have the options out there to be able to do contracts for one person with an out-of-network provider.
But there again, it is up to your provider to do that, to want to do that. So really you could see that effect happening, where there's no mechanism for DHS or DDS to make all of the providers join all of the passes. There's no way to enforce all of the providers taking those steps to bill those passes for which they might be out of network. So you can potentially see this exclusivity of providers in certain passes. So I am not very optimistic that you're going to see folks able to keep their providers, at least not initially. I think that
there are providers who are signing up as a provider with each of the passes, so it's a mixture. It's up to the pass and to the provider.
As well, they should. I mean, why would you not want to have that volume of potential patients? I can see the administrative burden it might add by now, instead of having to bill one basically insurance provider, Medicaid, now you're having to bill four more people in addition to the Medicaid patients you probably still have. So there is that added administrative burden without any extra incentive to join those passes except for keeping those patients you have. So for
many of our providers, that's exactly why they did limit how many they enrolled with. It was not because they don't want the business, and it was not because they don't want to make sure they could serve everyone. But as a provider, they don't know what outcomes do you track, who do you report it to, how do you bill, how long is it going to take them to pay, what are they going to allow you to be paid for each individual. There's so many variables that many providers did not want to spread that out over four different passes in the beginning. I think we'll see more and more sign up across the board as we move further into the process. But I think anyone out there who is attributed to a pass, If it's not a pass that you already knew, you have to remember the state has given you the opportunity to change, a short time frame in there, but you do have that opportunity. And you need to say to your providers, this is who I just got attributed to. Are you in this pass? And if not, will you join? And talk with your providers. I think they want to work with people out there, but I think they're just as concerned as the families right now about that process.
And obviously I'm confused about this, but I've heard a lot of parents are confused also, and some don't even understand that they need to sign up for a pass because, well, I already have the waiver. How can parents find out more about this and make informed decisions?
Well, so if they're already on the waiver, they really won't need to sign up for a pass necessarily. They're going to be contacted by a company called Optum in order to go through an assessment to see what their level of need will be and what tier level of services they'll be provided. That's going to automatically happen. Then they will be what's called attributed to a pass. So DHS is going to just assign them to a pass. And the way it started was DHS was going to look at your history with your providers and determine which pass you should be in based on the provider's membership. Now, I think they've stopped doing that, and it's just next one in line. We're just going to assign pass A, pass B, pass C. So they will be attributed to a pass, and they'll be notified of that attribution. It will then be up to them to decide within 90 days. They have the freedom to freely change passes if they identify one that they'd rather be in. And after that 90 days has passed, you're kind of locked in for a while, except during open enrollment, just like any other health insurance program, or you can change your passes for cause. And that cause is defined in the rules as a number of different things, like you're not getting timely access to your services, they're not providing the services they need, and of course, just with any other dispute you might have with Medicaid or your insurance provider, you can call us and we can help you with that. So there's not you're not locked in forever. And you can change your pass provider under those circumstances and in those time frames. So it's just going to it's going to take some research on your part. All the passes are very good at having their beneficiary handbooks available online for you to view, so you can see if your provider is a member of that pass, or if there's anything any of the other passes offer that you think would better serve your needs.
They should all have websites that are up, and on the Arkansas Waiver Association Facebook page. Last year at our conference, we had the passes come and address the group. There were families there as well as other providers. What we had continued to hear families say is, how am I supposed to make a choice when I don't even know who these people are? Each one of the passes came and did a presentation, and those presentations are permanently linked on that Facebook page. So you can go to that page, see the presentation that they made to everyone, and that can also help you get to their web page.
Arkansas
Waiver Association Facebook page.
And when you're asking about how they could learn more about the passes, my understanding is that the Department of Human Services is currently conducting community meetings, inviting families to come to those to find out more about it. I will say one thing that's a real problem for families right now is there's so much that is still being finalized about this. It was only recently that the passes signed contracts with the state, and my understanding, are there still a couple that don't have contracts, or do they all now have?
I think all four of them are up and have their contracts prepared. I think that the big concern now is just the initiation is 6 weeks away.
And they were not able to contract with the providers to provide services until they had everything, all the details ironed out with DHS. So everything is being compressed into a very short time frame. And there are still some families being assigned to passes. And so it doesn't give a lot of time to figure out what's going on when there's limited information. That's been one of the biggest challenges, I think.
And who is monitoring this program to make sure that everything's being done according to law and everyone's still able to access the services that they're supposed to?
Well, so there's supposed to be data collected from providers. So providers will collect data about patient outcomes, quality of services, and provide that on a quarterly basis to the PASSes who provide it to DHS. DHS is going to engage a third-party contractor to come in and perform surveys of a select population of beneficiaries to see how they feel about the PASSes. They're going to keep track of any grievances or calls to DHS's support line. So they have the plan to collect the data that they need to see how well it's going. Ultimately, it's going to be up to DHS and DDS or DAABH to determine whether or not the level of care meets their definition of adequacy.
And in addition, our organizations are trying to keep an eye on what's happening leading up, and we're going to be also trying to listen. We really don't have a direct stake in this. Our staff are not getting services. Well, some of them are as family members, but the agency is not benefiting directly from this. So we're trying to listen to families, providers, and the state to make sure that things will go well for everyone. And I'm sure there are going to be major changes that are made over the first few years as we work all the bugs out in this. One thing I'm really promoting is that we will begin to tie the work of the passes to a series of data that's being collected now called the National Core Indicators that looks at life outcomes for individuals with disabilities. And I would love to see see a report card showing how each of the passes are doing relative to their participants in that pass with those national core indicators.
Each pass is also required under the Arkansas law to have a consumer advisory council. Mm-hmm. And that's to be made up of stakeholders from the program that could certainly hear information from families and bring that back to an entity that the PASS is required by law to listen to.
So have any of those been set up yet?
There are a couple out there that are going and going pretty strong. I think it all depends on how much you believe in the concept, on how far it's been promoted so far. But it has a lot of really strong components to it within the law. There was a patient bill of rights that was written in there, and so I think there is some protection with that as well. Mm-hmm. It's not just a wild idea out there that, you know, like we've said, it's happened in other states. It is federally regulated. It's going to have to be tweaked, and there's going to be problems as we go along. But hopefully, we could make this into something that could help benefit people. That's the ultimate goal.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. We're talking about policies impacting children with developmental disabilities, and we're specifically right now talking about the new PASS program to access services for developmental disabilities. And you mentioned, and David did too, this has been, or something similar or the same basic concept has been implemented in other states. So how has that played out in other states? What's worked well, what hasn't, and what do you hope that the state will learn and adopt from that?
I think it's really uneven as to how this has gone in different states. Some states, I would call a disaster. Other states, it's gone fairly well. And I think we should say we've been pointing out all the things we're concerned about. This does have the potential to really serve people better than we ever have. There's more flexibility in things that are provided, services that are provided for people with disabilities and behavioral health issues. So there is the potential for it to be better than it's ever been. And I think one thing to do is to look at the states that have done well. And I think the oversight and monitoring is a big piece of the places where it has gone well, having, like Cindy was talking about, the consumer input and involvement is a big piece of it. And actually going beyond what we traditionally have focused on, including things like supported employment, helping people to be gainfully employed where they can support themselves and not depend on tax dollars to support them and to have a much better quality of life. When we do that, everybody wins. And we have learned so much more over the last 10 years and really the last 5 years about how to support people with significant disabilities to be successfully employed, and in many cases for the employers to say, by golly, these are our best employees that we have.
I think that's so true. I think that people, we're actually quite lucky because we work with a group of individuals that receive Medicaid, but they want to work and they desperately want jobs. And all they need is for somebody out there that has a business or that needs an employee to open up and give them the chance to try that. And they become fantastic employees for us. But I also, I have to try to be positive about where the change is going. It's going to happen whether we're positive or not. I believe in Arkansas and Arkansas families, and I do not believe the people of this state think that it's going to be acceptable for the group that we're talking about to not get the care that they really want and really need. Every time that people have learned that, they've risen to the occasion. We've got some incredibly strong families out there. Mm-hmm. They're going to make sure people get what they need. They're going to keep the pressure on to make sure those stories come to the forefront. And I think if everybody just stays alert, what we're going to be able to do is make this program work to where we can have something better than what we have right now. But it will take everyone to make that happen.
Any last thoughts on the new PASS program before we talk about education?
Well, I think it's important for families to understand that they don't just have to take what the PASS is giving them. There is a grievance process that allows them the opportunity to provide evidence to that PASS or just complain to that PASS. And that becomes a record that then the PASS has to get to DHS and explain why they didn't provide a service that the family feels that that's needed. So it's really, it's that, that mechanism of due process and the creation of a record is going to end up making the system better the more times you do it. Also, DHS is going to establish a beneficiary support center that if you feel like your PASS isn't listening to you, or you don't think the grievance process is working, or your PASS has turned down your grievance, or for whatever reason you feel like your PASS isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing, I really encourage families to be that squeaky wheel and complain, because when you complain, that is the only way we can point to the need for a systems change. Because we can speculate all we want, and we do that as part of, you know, commenting on proposed rules and regulations and trying to anticipate what's going to happen. But ultimately, we're going to have to point to incidences of people not getting services if we're going to make a systems change. The system has to first not be working for us to be able to say it needs to be changed. So I really encourage folks, anytime you have the opportunity to speak out and to be an advocate for yourself or your family member, that you need to do it.
That goes for all the issues that Arkansas Advocates works on, too. if you see a problem, speak out.
And I think it's also important for families to talk to one another. And that's one of the big concerns, is that families won't even realize they have options if they're not satisfied with what's happening. And we are trying to get that word out, but it's important for families to, you know, they have networks, they talk to one another, and they need to make one another aware of that option.
We just have about 10 minutes left, but I did want to talk about education programs for children enrolled in public schools that have developmental disabilities. I understand there are some laws that help provide them with the opportunities that they need to be successful in school. Can you talk about some of those programs in the public schools?
Sure. Well, you know, there's the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act that for any child who has a disability that impacts their education, they are required to be educated in the least restrictive environment possible, and they're required to be provided by the school free of charge supports and services as necessary to make sure that they're given the opportunity to participate in a free and appropriate public education. That's kind of the pole star for education for children with disabilities. There are also for folks who need reasonable accommodations and might not need a specialized plan for their education. Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act requires schools to provide accommodations to an individual as necessary for them to participate in the education program. And so for individuals with severe disabilities that impact their education and they need a individualized plan to participate in public education, there are a wide range of services that are available to individuals to make sure that they can be educated in their least restrictive environment, whether it's an aid, whether it's tutoring, whether it's it could even be services to the parent if necessary, specialized transportation. Really, if you can identify a way that a school can educate a child in a less restrictive environment than they're already being educated, the school district has to do that, or something that's going to have that effect of educating them in that least restrictive environment.
And one very important component of that process is every year there is an individual plan that's written for each student, and having a really solid plan is an important part of that, because that's what becomes the blueprint for the services that student gets. And so there may be things that you think they should have, but if it's not written into that plan, it may not happen, and it needs to be as specific as possible. And the organizations that Cindy mentioned earlier that make up the PTI for the state, the Parent Training and Information Center, they're charged with helping families to understand this whole process and to navigate the issues of special education. And I would say in most years that would be the number one issue for the families that we work with. Passes have superseded that this year, but the education issues still are very present.
And we probably get, I know that special education is our number one call. We get calls from more people with issues with their education plans than any other call combined, probably. So there are there is a huge need out there. And we provide resources to parents that explain rights under the IDEA on our website, disabilityrightsar.org. So if anybody has any questions about their rights and through the IDEA process, there are two guides that are on that website that will explain their rights and the process itself.
So those are excellent. I can't say enough about how much those guides have helped families.
I would like to see Disability Rights Arkansas train the past care coordinators in how to advocate for families that have educational needs, help spread some of that knowledge. I think there are some very basic things with some school districts that could help out there. Individuals that are a tier one on the DD scale, I believe it's July, can voluntarily enroll in the past, even though it's a tier one, and they will get a care coordinator, which could help them then with some educational advocacy. But I would love to see a link up between those two groups and those two programs and some of that information to share out there, so there's even more advocacy available.
That sounds wonderful. I don't work in the education arena, so I'll speak for them.
So we'll make that happen.
You're going to voluntold them.
That's right.
Yep.
So what are the most common questions that you do get from parents? Is it just not understanding what all services are available to their children?
For education?
Yes.
Oh, well, it's such a range of problems that we encounter, all the way back to they haven't even been identified as a child with a disability who needs special education or related services. up to expulsion or placing them on homebound or really restrictive environments due to manifestations of their disability without going through a behavior planning process or trying something else before moving to a really restrictive environment. So we see some really ugly things out there.
Placed in restraints or in seclusion, and kids getting broken bones sometimes from this. It can get pretty nasty. There are some schools that do a great job and others that don't.
How common is the not good at all programs in schools? I mean, are those outliers? I mean, you hear about them, but it's not commonplace?
Well, I think the extreme cases, yeah, I was just talking about are the outliers.
Yeah.
What's more common is the family wants a service for the child and the school says, no, we're going to accommodate their needs in a different way.
Sometimes,
and a big part
of
that,
how.
Pardon?
Thomas had said it costs too much. And I said, yep, and sometimes we don't know how. You're asking for something the school has no idea of what to do.
And part of the cost issue is the federal government has never fully funded special education. I think the most they've ever given is like 25 cents on the dollar of what would be required. So school districts have to make up the difference. And they're viewing that, well, if I provide this accommodation for this student, that means we're going to have to cut funding for the band program or for languages. And so it's a balancing act that they have. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times families don't know enough to be clear and specific about what they want. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's just a clear difference of opinions. And one thing that families should understand is that when they're signing off on the plan for their child, they do not have to sign if they don't agree with what the school says. You know, there can be a grievance process and a way to try to resolve those differences. A lot of times in the planning session, there may be six faculty members from the school and one parent. And
it can be intimidating.
It can be intimidating.
And never sign a blank form.
And that happens.
That's
that
also happens. A good general rule.
True.
In life. That's, yeah, right.
So with a minute left, just really quickly, if you could say your organizations again and where people can find resources from y'all.
Sure. Thomas Nichols with Disability Rights Arkansas. Call us. Go to our website, www.disabilityrightsar.org. And we've got lots of resources there.
And David Deere with Partners for Inclusive Communities. And our website is U of A Partners.
Cindy Alberding with the Arkansas Waiver Association. We have a website at arkansaswaiver.org. We do the majority of our communication with families, individuals, and providers through our Facebook page.
Well, thank you all for being here today. We really appreciate it. And Arkansas Advocates will be back next month. Thank you so much.
KABF and Speak Up Arkansas would like to thank our underwriters, Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, the Arkansas Education Association, Arkansas Children's, and the Arkansas Coalition for Peace and Justice, all supporting KABF, the voice of the people.
KABF, Community Radio, 88.3 Little Rock. We come to you in many languages and cultures, presenting shows and programs in various arts and craft disciplines.
Today on Wings, women asylum seekers fleeing violence in Guatemala.
No puedo salir, no puedo ir a dar un vuelto allá abajo a comprar cosas que ustedes necesiten, le digo yo. Pero no puedo, porque se me quedan viendo todas las personas. There's a river.